Hi, I'm Ashley Ann, and I'm at the Museum of Contemporary Art, Chicago, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you, Ashley Ann. Good morning and welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. This is show number 885. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty in the WGN radio studio today. So a tip of the hat to Bob. And thank you for joining the show today. We have an action-packed show lined up for you. So a couple of weeks ago, I spoke with Tyrone Williams, who is a wonderful educator. He is at Oak Park and River Forest High School, and he is the Gilder Lehrman Teacher of the Year for History for the State of Illinois 2023. And that was a really wonderful conversation to have to celebrate the art of teaching. And today what we'll do is we'll take another look at teaching, but there's also some hard realities to face that, especially over the last few years, there is this teacher attrition crisis where many people are leaving the teaching profession. So we will explore a documentary that is in production that deals with this topic. Also, did you hear about that one fair wage ordinance that was recently passed into law? What does this mean for tipping when we go to restaurants? We'll explore that. And is it really a fair wage? We will talk to someone who has some thoughts about that. And the secret history of Chicago music segment. We learn about a very cool girl garage rock group from the 1960s called The Same. They're from the northwest suburbs of Chicago. So look, it's totally action-packed. I'm glad you're here. Strap on in. Here we go. As many who listen to this program are aware, my full-time job is a high school history teacher locally, and it's a great job. And, of course, it's one that has a unique set of challenges. Here's something. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, hundreds of thousands of teachers and school staff have resigned since 2020. So the question here is the education system failing the teachers? Well, there is a documentary in production right now that explores this question. It's called Failure to Fail. And this is an MFA thesis documentary. The director of this film is Haley Breese, and she is with us here on Outside the Loop today. Haley, welcome to the show.
Hi, yeah, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So this project, like I said, this is a thesis documentary that you're doing here. The website, we should say, is failure-to-fail.com. We will link up to that. So how did this project come about? Because as I understand it, you are a former teacher, aren't you?
I am, yes. So I taught for 3 years over in Florida. And then COVID hit, and I decided that I was going to take a little bit of a break, take a little bit of a step back, and go back to school for my master's. So education has always been my passion and my main excitement, I would say, but also filmmaking. So I get to bridge those two things together with this project.
And where are you in school now?
I am over in Savannah, Georgia, over at SCAD, Savannah College of Art and Design.
So this topic here, this film, Failure to Fail, this is dealing with the teacher attrition that we have really been seeing, especially in the last few years. You said you're into education, but the idea here about what you're doing specifically, you're focusing on that attrition. Tell us about the angle that you're taking with this documentary.
Yeah. So with this doc, it is a short form doc. So unfortunately, there's a lot of different facets to this problem, but we don't have the time to look at all of them. So we are mostly focusing on the element called standards-based grading or grade inflation and the pressure that that is putting on teachers on top of everything else that they have to go through with this position. And so we're really looking at why are teachers leaving the field and does this have something to do with it, and exploring that in this doc.
So you have interviews with teachers that you are currently gathering, former teachers. Can you tell us some of the things that they're saying here in terms of their reasons for leaving the profession? I know you said standards-based grading. We might not know what that means. Grade inflation. For the average person, you know, who might be coming into this topic, what are you also hearing these teachers say about the reasons for leaving?
Yeah, so the majority of teachers that have left the profession or are contemplating leaving are mostly stating that they're thinking about this or have done this because they feel overwhelmed and burnt out. Teacher burnout is a huge issue, and the burnout comes from working a lot more hours than people think, especially, you know, you hear you get your summers off and your winter breaks off, but what not a lot of people realize is that teachers spend that time lesson planning and preparing for the next year or even coming back after winter break. So it's this idea that teachers are endlessly working. They're doing everything they can. And that idea has led to a lot of burnout. Teachers are finding that they don't have time to spend with their families or, you know, do the things that they want to do because they have to be available 24/7, basically. And then on top of that, teachers have also mentioned that they've left the profession or are leaving because of the lack of student accountability and behavior of students, as well as like parents. So it's a big question, but a lot of them are having problems with just support. Feeling supported and then being overburdened with a lot of extra things to where they're starting to feel burnt out.
Yeah, I can totally see that. And, you know, it's something because teachers, all the teachers I know, are so committed to their students, and they want to do right by their students. And a lot of them feel that, boy, I need to get this right. And there's just not enough time in the day. I mean, honestly, as a teacher, there's not enough time in the day to construct a lesson, to grade everything. And so we always take our work home. I mean, all of us do, you know? And mm-hmm. So the stress of that, I think, is a very real thing here. But also what you're talking about, how there is a student accountability issue about grades and what do those mean. And that's certainly a complicated conversation. But the title of this film is Failure to Fail. Tell us how that title fits into what you're hearing here.
Yeah, absolutely. So the title Failure to Fail actually stems from nursing programs and how nursing students were just being pushed through without them having to show their clinical studies and to put in the work. So that idea of failure to fail is a kind of an umbrella for pushing students through without them showing that they are capable or even have mastered any of the subjects or standards that we've talked about or that we show in class. So that's where the backstory of Failure to Fail comes from. And what it represents is basically, like I said, an umbrella term. And it's looking at... So how I explain it, it's kind of a lot, but how I explain it is basically there has been a push for looking at education and changing it in some way. And a lot of people are looking at, well, how do we grade? And so they're looking at grade reform and this new way of grading and how this new way of grading is going to close the gap. And there's going to be a lot of great things about it. But what we're finding is this way of grading, which is called standardized based grading. It has other names, but that's the main one. That is contributing to this lack of student accountability and the burnout of teachers, because how it's the grade reform is set up is that students will have an unlimited amount of time to submit projects, to submit papers, just anything in class, including tests. They have an unlimited time to retake tests until they have reached mastery. But since this is such a new concept, we're finding that there's a lot of pitfalls with it, and teachers are getting extremely frustrated, and they're not getting support from admin or really anybody. So they feel very alone. And then they are seeing the effects of this in the classroom through student behavior, through students' outcomes. And unfortunately, the short end of the stick is that students aren't getting ready or being prepared, and teachers' hands are tied. So that's what we're also really looking at in this doc, is just what are the effects of this, and how is this leading to the teacher burnout rate as well?
I know that you're looking for people to talk to. So if there are any teachers who are hearing this conversation out there, or people that work at schools and are saying to themselves, boy, this sounds familiar to me, we can go to the website and check that out, because you want to hear from some of these people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I am collecting as many voices on this opinion as possible, whether you're a teacher or even admin or parents. If you've been, if this resonates with you, we are looking to interview a wide range of individuals surrounding this topic. So yeah, on the website, there's a link to where you can go to see ways to help. And we have a Google form, if you'd like to participate, that we have put up for people to put in their information, and then we get in contact, and then we would schedule like a pre-interview.
This is, as we've been talking about, Haley, just a massive topic, but it's a really important topic. And what do you want people to take away from this documentary ultimately when it's done? What's the takeaway here?
The biggest takeaway that I want people to get from this documentary is I want them to, one, look at our education system and ask themselves, like, is this the best we can do for not only our students, but also our teachers? And start asking these questions of your school boards, and also think about the teachers who are taking care of your students or of your kids, because ultimately they are going to be our future. And they're going to be running this country, which is a very scary thought, you know. However, I want everybody, regardless if you have kids in the education system or not, to really think about the effects that can happen when we don't support education and we aren't asking these important questions as to how we are conducting our education field or our education system in the United States.
The website is failure-to-fail.com for the documentary that is currently in production called Failure to Fail. And when do you expect that this documentary will be done, Haley?
Yeah, so we are expecting a release date of our doc in May 2024.
All right. But in the meantime, we can go to the website and learn more and even get involved in the production of this documentary. And we'll definitely check back in May when this comes out, Haley. I'm excited to check it out, but we should go to the website in the meantime. Haley Brees is the director and the editor of this film in production called Failure to Fail. Haley, thank you for talking to us today and for all of your hard work about this really important topic, and best of luck going forward.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mike. I really appreciate it. And thank you for having me on again and getting this out. We really want to hear everyone's voices.
Let's talk about one of my favorite topics, food, or more specifically, the wages of those who serve us our food at Chicago restaurants. Recently, the Chicago City Council passed the One Fair Wage Ordinance, which phases in minimum wage pay for restaurant employees over the next 5 years, so these employees don't have to rely on tips on top of a sub-minimum wage. Many cheered this law's passage, including Mayor Johnson. However, food writer Michael Nagrant recently penned a critique of this ordinance, and he is here with us today to tell us his thoughts on what's going on with this one fair wage ordinance. Michael Nagrant is a food writer and, as he likes to say, the last food critic for the Chicago Sun-Times. I love that. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You are very welcome. So this piece that you wrote, The Unfair Wages of Restaurant Politics, this was on your, I think I'm saying this right, this is your Substack, essentially like your channel, right? I feel like an old man saying this, but it's your Substack.
Yeah, it's for people who don't know, Substack is like a newsletter, but it gets pushed to your inbox, right? So it's like what all the cool kids are doing right now. but like you, I myself am an old man, so it's amazing I'm even doing it. But yeah, 100%.
We'll just unite our forces as two old guys talking about food and wages here. So, all right, briefly here, Mike, explain this new law, this one fair wage law. How does it work? What do we need to know going forward with this?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, there's a lot of details here, but ultimately, if I'm going to boil it down, the way that it works today before the law is minimum wage in Chicago for non-tipped workers is like roughly $9.48 an hour. If you're a minimum wage worker who's not tipped, it's basically $15.80, right? And so with the new law, what I should say is that if you were a server or a tipped wage earner and you were making that $9.48 an hour, the law in Chicago prior to this new law said restaurant owners had to still pay you $15.80. So if for some reason your tips didn't make up to $15.80, then the restaurant would pay you that difference. Now, with the new law, the way that it works is everybody, whether you're tipped or non-tipped, will get $15.80 eventually. But the way that the law has been enacted or will be enacted is with a compromise is that they're going to phase in that up to $15.80. So you're going to start with like $9.48, and then each year, I believe it's going to go up roughly about a dollar and a quarter until they reach $15.80 somewhere near year five. I guess the other thing I should say about this, though, is that most tipped wage earners were making well over $15.80.
Right.
So even though they were getting paid $9.48 an hour or whatever it is as a minimum pay, because they were being tipped at the restaurants or wherever they're working, that those tips plus that minimum wage typically was way more than $15.80. So if you were at $9.48 and then, you know, that goes $1.25 next year, most people are going to get trued up to $15.80. However, what's interesting about this is the people who are going to make more money initially in the phase-in are the people who are making over $15.80, because those people were making over $15.80 with their tips, plus they were getting $9.48. Now they're going to get $9.48 plus that new $1.25 per hour, plus whatever they were making in tips as well. So actually, the people who are making more money are actually going to see more money initially with this law, which is one of those funky reasons I've criticized the law, right?
Yeah.
Now, long term, as it gets to $15.80, then yeah, everybody theoretically is going to see a raise in that base. But it's going to take 5 years to get there, right? And then the other thing about it is that if $15.80, right, if you're working 40 hours a week, which is difficult to do for 52 weeks a year in Chicago, obviously with holidays and closures and things like that, sure. I don't even know if that's possible. But let's say you do. Let's say you're hustling. That's $32,000 a year after taxes, right? Or before taxes, I should say. You know, taxes is probably going to take a significant chunk out of that. Well, we know in Chicago, the average rental is $2,100 a month, right? So again, if you're a worker who's making this bare minimum wage of, you know, and you're at $32,000 before taxes, and let's say you find an average rental, you know, you're at 24,000 and some change in rent already, right? So it doesn't leave much for food or whatever. Probably doesn't after taxes, frankly. Now, of course, you know, maybe you'll find something lower than that. These are averages. But still, I mean, I guess the other thing I question about that is if you're really a true progressive, like the mayor says, or any member of this progressive alderman caucus, is it really a fair wage, right? Like, I mean, ultimately, what I fundamentally believe the city should do if they really believe in providing a fair wage is figuring out what that cost of living is based on living in Chicago, and then say, hey, we know we can't put this onus on just restaurant owners, and we can't put this on diners or consumers. We believe in this as a governmental action and also as a value. And let's say that number is 40,000 or 50,000. I don't know what it is, but I know it's probably not 32,000 given what I've said. And so then the government could put some skin in the game and say, hey, we're going to allocate some money to help restaurant people and restaurant owners achieve this goal.
So what happens to tips? I mean, does tipping go away? Because if these workers get up to 1580, are we still then tipping on top of that? How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, it remains to be seen, but I would say this. What we have seen preempted to this is that in the restaurant industry, because people were tipping generously to the front of the house, you had a disparity between servers in the front of the house and, say, chefs in the back of the house or in the kitchen. And so, you know, chefs would get paid either, you know, minimum wage, or they get paid a salary. Servers would get paid that minimum wage, but then they would get the tips. And because patrons are generous and they're tipping 15 to 20% on average or whatever it might be, the folks in the front of the house were making a lot more money. And as you can imagine, that would create a disparity in the staff, because you're like, hey, I'm working just as hard as you are. I do a significant thing in the restaurant. Shouldn't I get paid more? And a lot of progressive restaurant owners saw that and they said, how do I correct that? Well, the laws are very, very stringent about touching tips. And so back in the day, for example, Charlie Trotter actually saw this really early, and he pulled tips and he then distributed it more evenly amongst his staff. That led to a lawsuit whereby folks sued who were servers and other people who were not in the kitchen staff who were benefiting from some of this ended up suing and winning a lawsuit. So one of the reasons those laws are very stringent today is because of that. So, but what you can do is you can create a service fee. And so restaurants like Lula Cafe, Daisy's, for example, Honey Butter Fried Chicken, a bunch of others in Chicago, has said, hey, let's impose a service fee, which is similar to a tip, like 15 or 20%. But this service fee can be collected by the restaurant owner and distributed how they see fit. So a lot of these progressive folks have done that, and they've equalized wages amongst their staff. One of the risks, of course, is that if you're a server, you'll probably make a little bit less in certain cases than if you were at another restaurant. But the thing about it is, in the past, they might lose those people in the new restaurant. So they like this law probably, because now it'll put them on a more equal playing field. Because what I think we're going to see is restaurant owners who are trying to recoup. Because the other thing about this law is that, again, the reason people were making so much money at these restaurants in the server role is because consumers were spending that money via tips. Restaurant owners were not putting money into this unless they were chewing people up who were below that 1580 threshold. But now with this law, what it is saying to the owners is, hey, you're going to have to pay that difference out of your pockets, not consumers necessarily. And so because of that, I think restaurant owners are going to say, hey, how do I get this money back, right? One of the ways they're going to do it is they could raise menu prices. They could, you know, go away from tipping like we've just talked about. They could impose the service fee, because then they get this money and then they can equalize wages amongst their staff. There's a lot of things that could happen here, right? But also, I mean, I think the thing that's interesting about it is if menu prices go up, for example, or if they are charging a service fee, it's most likely that consumers will see that. They'll feel it in their wallet. They'll feel it on the bill. And even if tipping is still available, which may or may not happen in the case of a service charge, some people say, hey, it's a service charge. There's no tip at all. We don't take tips. Some people still say we will take tips on top of it right now. In the future, I think as a consumer, even if you're generous and you want to tip on top of that, you're certainly not going to tip as much as you were. So I think what you're going to see is that servers may end up making, especially the servers who have really good jobs, who are making really good wages, folks who are at like those four-star restaurants that don't charge a service fee, that allow their servers to get tips. Some of these people are actually making high five or six or low six figures. And those folks are the ones that I think are going to see their wages diminish as well over time as restaurant owners do switch to the service model. There's no guarantee they will, but it does feel like that is where it may go.
So bottom line here, from what you're saying, if As you say in your piece, if Mayor Johnson was a true progressive, he would pursue an actual fair wage law that bumps annual minimum wages to a real living wage. That's directly from what you wrote in your piece on your Substack. So really, that's what it comes down to here. If we're talking about trying to get folks to a living wage, maybe we should just set whatever the hourly rate is at an actual living wage for the city.
I think that's right. And I think the other thing about it, too, is that I'm hearing a lot about optics here that especially early in an administration that I really don't like. So, as I said in my piece, I voted for Mayor Johnson. I voted for Lori Lightfoot first, but ultimately when we got to the runoff, I felt that Mayor Johnson was going to be a better choice personally. Right. So I supported the guy. I supported his vision. Right. But the flip side of it is, you know, late in the campaign, we saw some things. For example, you know, the guy was behind on his water bills, right? And I believe the dollar figure they gave was like $3,000. It's not just like an incidental mistake that he made. He also had like $400 in parking tickets. Again, everybody's got parking tickets. I get it, you know. But when you start to put that together for a guy who's running a city that runs on a $1 billion budget, you start to think about that. And I think it's interesting, right? Because nobody really talked about that. They just said, oh, the mayor was buying $3,000. He paid it off. We're all good, right? But there's these like little things I'm starting to see. And then when I talked to restaurant owners and restaurant people who were at the forefront of this debate, who were talking to aldermen on the front lines. Like I talked to a particular restaurant owner who spoke with 12 different aldermen about this law. And the feedback they gave me was that both either through that alderman with direct conversations to the mayor or even directly with the mayor, the conversation was, I ran on this one fair wage law. I am going to get it passed no matter what. And you know, he's like, and by the way, some of these aldermen, apparently, what they heard was, hey, we hear what you're saying, that this law doesn't do what we said it does. But you know what? It's called one fair wage. I'm not going to vote against something called one fair wage, whether it's fair or not, right? And so what I'm seeing from this administration, rather than leadership, rather than looking for real change, looking to impose the vision that they said they would, they're just kind of doing like bare minimums, or they're doing the optical thing that looks like they're making progress, or that they're really building up the city in the way that they said they were. But I think when you look underneath the cover so far, that's not happening. And I think that's what I'm concerned about with this administration.
Well, getting a little politics in there as well. But really, this is it's all connected, you know, and I think that this is something that we need to continue to pay attention to. And of course, we want folks to have a living wage and to work hard and live comfortably because, you know, we deserve that here. So taking a look at this is really important. And again, this piece called The Unfair Wages of Restaurant Politics, it's on Michael Nagrin's Substack. You can go to thehunger.substack.com and we will link up to that as well. Michael Nagrant, food writer, and of course, the last food critic for the Chicago Sun-Times. Hey, Mike, I really enjoyed this conversation. Thanks for shining some light on this issue, and we'll do it again in the future.
I really appreciate it, and I look forward to it.
Occasionally in the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
What? Once again, connecting across town to the lair of an apartment of one Mr. Steve Krakow, also known as Plastic Crime Wave, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip. And this week, Steve, I dig it. We are thinking about and hearing music from a 1960s girl group, kind of like a garage rock feel. They are called The Same. I think these girls rock.
They totally are great. And this is definitely one, I stumble on some artists sometimes. Sometimes people write me. This is one I've been after to get the story for a long time. So I'm stoked to finally tell the tale. And that some of their material is coming out for us to hear. That's like a new thing, too.
Yeah, this kind of like a revitalization when it comes to this band, The Same. And I like the sound a lot. And, they're online now. They've got a Facebook page that happened in March of this year. So things are starting to pop. It only took, 60 years or something like that. But The Same finally getting some recognition. So originally they're from the Northwest suburbs. How did they get started here, Steve?
Oh, it's a charming tale, I have to say, and a similar one to others I've heard. Actually, they were basically a bunch of like junior high gals that were like obsessed with the Beatles, went to see them at the famous show at International Amphitheater here in September 1964. I guess there's kind of almost a big anniversary coming up there on that one.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, soon next year. Basically we're just in love with them and we're like, how can we meet the Beatles? What if we started a band and got huge and then we could meet the Beatles, And it's just funny because I've heard so many stories about like the Beatles just, of course they were a huge inspiration and a huge influence on so many people, but like the inspiration, that was basically it. And, they kind of went from there. It almost started as a joke, and I've even sort of heard that before, and then it kind of became reality.
That's incredible. So these girls, they go to high school together. Several of them go to Wheeling High School, and they're dreaming about the Beatles, trying to meet the Beatles. So they think, hey, let's start the band. And so they do some covers. They do some Beatles covers. You've Got to Hide Your Love Away. They do that one. And, like we're talking about, they're covering kind of, as you say here, the three chord garage rock anthems. So tell us about the, I guess you could call it the hit, right? It's 1967. There's a single and it's a pretty good tune.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of sad to find out the story of that tune because it's to be honest, it's a depressing story. And another one that I've heard a lot, it's like, okay, so everyone's like, you girls are great. You got to go out to LA and record. That's where the biz is. You got to go out there. Okay, cliche number one. So they actually get management and, they get it set up to go record out there, and they're like, oh yeah, we're gonna have all your guitars there and everything you need, and it's gonna be great. And then of course they get there, business dudes basically commandeering the session and are like, actually you're not playing on this song. This goes back to like even very famous songs that people don't think about, like the Byrds' Mr. Tambourine Man. That's Roger McGuinn and some guys. Those are session people. They would do that even to like pretty, to the most talented of bands. They would just be like, no, we know what makes a hit and you're privileged to be here and you just do what we say. And it happened to dudes, and I feel like it especially happened, to ladies, and they were young ladies, they were chaperoned, but they're in high school, so they were of course like, okay, I guess if this, so they had to do a rearrangement of the song that they brought, which was written by like a friend of the band, Sunshine Flowers of the Rain. And then the studio foisted another song upon them. It's like, you're going to learn this right now and you're going to record it. And they didn't even like it. It was nothing like their style. And they, I guess, turned the song Sunshine Flowers in the Rain a little more into a sort of orchestrated, I guess what they call these days more like sunshine pop, you know, maybe mm-hmm. just because the word is in the title, but it's more of a, you know, soft orchestrated pop thing. And they're like, well, our arrangement was actually kind of more like a hard folk rock kind of thing, you know? So their harmonies still come through. The song, it's a good tune. So like, and I like sort of saccharine sunshine pop kind of stuff too.
Sure.
So I, you know, I'm a little more forgiving, but I can totally see. And then of course you hear these demos where you hear that they can actually rock and you're like, ah, okay, I see what happened here. But you know, they got to hang out in LA for a while. It was all on the label's dime, or, you know, that they went out and stayed in a hotel and they got to meet the Beach Boys, like walking down the Sunset Strip and stuff like that. So I think they had a good time, but it sounds like the studio, well, the sad thing is most of them sang harmonies, but one member didn't, and so she did nothing on the 45. Nothing.
Oh, she was just there for the ride.
She didn't know that going there, but yeah, you know, like she thought she was going to, you know, be playing drums. No. Donna was on drums. Was she on bass? She was just the one member who didn't sing harmonies of the band. And that's all the group ended up doing, was singing harmonies. Sunshine.
Not a great experience, but they cut some tunes. What happens after that experience?
Well, sadly, the reality, all too typical reality of them being high school kids is it's pretty hard to hold a very professional band together when you're in high school and everyone is graduating and going their separate ways and getting married. It's obviously a very, you know, sort of transitional time in life. So all those things basically ended up happening that I mentioned: getting married, having kids, people moving away. The singer went down to Champaign, and she did come back for a little bit, but she started playing this other band, Fat Water, who is going to be another feature coming up. Cool. Get ready for that.
I'm ready.
You are going to be, this is some like acid rock.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
Yeah. So anyway, so yeah. And you know, honestly, they all went on to play music. The drummer was in this other band I've been curious about, who did, I think, just a single, if I'm not mistaken, called The Chips, another all-girl band. Surprisingly, a lot of them were in all these all-girl bands for a while. There was just more of them than people think, you know, I in that era, you know. Mm-hmm. But there was a reunion. There was a famous club out in Arlington Heights called The Cellar that, like, all these Shadows of Night, it was almost like their home base space, basically, because all these bands really lived in the suburbs, you
right
know?
Right.
And so there was a reunion in, was it 89 or 99?
99.
Yeah. Where a full on same reunion happened. They were the only band. It sounded like it was a little Spinal Tappy, and there were disasters, of sorts. Sadly, the singer couldn't perform. She got like sick or something. And, Judy, like, she twisted her ankle or did something really mad. She messed up getting off the stage and actually had to go to the hospital. I had to go to the ER, if I'm not mistaken. Wait, let me get this.
And then,
right,
then she returned to the venue later on.
Yeah, she came back. Yes.
All right, we have to give a special shout out here, because you also, in addition to getting the story of whoever you are profiling, you do a hand drawing of that musician or the band. And up until this point, for years, you've been doing it on your own. And this time we have a special guest artist, Steve.
Yes, I recruited my partner, special lady, friend, Sarah Gossett. She did the pattern work because that is one of her areas. She's mostly a painter, but that's one of her areas of expertise. And the same of these really cool matching suits always. And they always had cool matching patterns on them. And I'm like, well, I could draw that, or I could get, you know, an artist who actually designs their own patterns and knows how to do it. So she applied her pattern to their suits, and she's a big fan of the girl groups of all sorts as well. So it was a little collaboration. We've done a few others in the past, but Secret History, this is the first time I've let someone in the artistic door.
How about that? Well, it looks great. The patterns look great. You got to go to chicagoreader.com or pick up a copy in the reader of The Secret History of Chicago Music. Also, Steve, really quickly, before we let you go here today, oh my goodness, it is such a special day because, sir, you were born this day some years ago. Happy birthday to you.
It's the big 5-0.
Oh!
So we're talking half a century. I think I now could have a secret history. I think I'm old enough to have my own secret history.
Someone has to do the secret history of the Plastic Crime Wave Syndicate Empire.
Right. Well, you can go see, currently up at Firecat Projects in Bucktown, there is indeed a gallery show retrospective of my work that coincided very nicely with this 50th birthday. It also doubles as a frame shop. So if you need framing done, check it out.
There it is. We'll do that for sure. Well, happy birthday, Steve Krakow, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip in the Chicago Reader. You're the best. Check out what he is writing and the drawings that he's doing this week. We're learning about the all-girl band from the northwest suburbs of Chicago called The Same. Hey, man, you're great. We love you. 50 more years of The Secret History of Chicago Music and Steve Krakow.
To quote the great Rufus Thomas, I ain't getting older, I'm getting better. Don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need somebody to love? Wouldn't you love somebody to love? You better find somebody to love.
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop, show number 885 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. You are the greatest. Bob Ferguson is the greatest as well. He is our engineer in the studio. Thanks, as always, to Ferg. I hope you have a wonderful week, and I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.